Hello, and welcome to our program, Smithsonian, brought to you by OWL Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Margie Lohoff, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Smithsonian's magazine here on OWL Radio. And this first article is from I'll first back up and remind our listeners that this magazine encompasses such a broad range of types of topics, including archaeology or pop culture or justice or medicine issues, education. The first thing, though, that we are going to be hearing about this time comes from the prologue section, which is sort of a potpourri that each issue of the magazine has. And this is under the category of genius. And it was written by Jeff McGregor. Genius. A whole new music. So genius in music. In the most American recording in history, one of our greatest jazz men raised the stakes for everyone who came after. So this would be especially important or of interest to those of you who love jazz. They gathered one afternoon in late October of 1960 at the Atlantic Records Studios in a nondescript building at 234 West 56th Street in New York. Pianist McCoy Tyner, just 21, a prodigy from Philadelphia. Steve Davis, upright bass, age 31, also from Philly. And Elvin Jones at 33, a veteran drummer who had played with everyone from Art Farmer and Pepper Adams to Gil Evans and Miles Davis. And then there was John Coltrane, 34, already widely acknowledged as the next great jazz saxophonist following Charlie Parker's death in 1955. The little band had been playing together since May. It was the first proper recording session for the John Coltrane Quartet, and it promptly produced one of the greatest moments in jazz history. Coltrane's rendition of Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein's My Favorite Things. A regular had recently shown Coltrane the sheet music one night at the Jazz Gallery, a club on St. Mark's Place in the East Village, and Coltrane thought he could make something of it. "We took it to rehearsal and just like that fell right into it," Coltrane said in a 1961 interview. It's a timeless song and quite possibly the most American recording in history. Composed by the grandsons of German and Russian Jews, about an Austrian family fleeing the Nazis on their way to America. Played by an African-American genius in a vernacular American style, produced by one Turkish-American for a record label owned by another Turkish-American. The recording is not in or of the melting pot. It is the melting pot. It was also a pivotal moment in Coltrane's career and in his artistry, a tipping point of technique and inspiration, of practice and poetry, of his widening understanding of himself and his place in things. In that single landmark recording, you can feel Coltrane fully embrace the entirety of his promise, not only as a saxophonist, but also as a band leader, composer, and arranger, and maybe as a man. Until that day, Coltrane had been the overachieving sideman, playing someone else's music in someone else's band. He was the best tenor player of his day, but was almost always standing in the long, cool shadow of lead trumpet players like Dizzy Gillespie or Miles Davis, both of whom eventually fired Coltrane for his unreliability and drug use. Davis had the uncanny grace, patience, and good luck to hire him back after he got clean. But once Coltrane kicked heroin in 1957, he imagined a new sound for himself and found new determination to create the music only he heard. Like every true prophet, Coltrane had wandered but was not lost. The Coltrane, who's a sideman for Miles Davis, is playing a completely different kind of music in a very different way, says Stephen Lewis, curator of music and performing arts at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And then what you see is this creative explosion once he's running his own band. And my favorite things from its opening cymbal crash was the first undeniable blast. Coltrane was born in Hamlet, North Carolina, in 1926. He was an only child. His father and his grandfather were both preachers, and you can sometimes hear the gospel style call and response cadence in his playing. When he was 12, those two men died. As a point of reference, the year Coltrane recorded My Favorite Things, the number one Billboard hit was the Percy Faith Orchestra playing The Theme from a Summer Place, a piece of movie music so anesthetic you could pipe it straight into any operating room in the world. My Favorite Things was just as recognizable as any other Billboard hit, one of the most beloved songs from one of the most beloved musicals in history, The Sound of Music. But unlike the early rock or novelty pop songs that charted in that era, it was also a song of deceptive complication, a bittersweet show tune pivoting between major and minor, from dark to bright, lighting Coltrane's way to something utterly new. And then there is a small article here by Brandon Tensley, The Key to Spirituality, that sort of dovetails with the first about Coltrane. A church in San Francisco gives new meaning to the term gospel music. Beyond his path-breaking musical accomplishments, John Coltrane might be the most spiritually divine jazz man in history. At least that's what congregants think at the St. John Coltrane African Orthodox Church in San Francisco. The church was established by two young lovers, Franzo and Marina King. While celebrating their first wedding anniversary in 1965, the couple went to a show at the Jazz Workshop, a beloved San Francisco nightclub. When Coltrane began to play, the Kings say, the performance felt like a message from God, almost a baptism by sound. The couple became convinced that Coltrane's art was a path toward spiritual enlightenment. By 1969, 2 years after Coltrane's death, they'd established the church at 1529 Galvez Avenue in San Francisco, and that same year, Franzo became a bishop in the Church of God in Christ. For congregants, the holy text is not the Bible, but rather A Love Supreme, Coltrane's 1965 album, considered by some to be his masterwork, which includes audio of Coltrane intoning a prayer. On the first Sunday of every month, the church invites jazz fans to participate in its Love Supreme meditation. The lights are dimmed, and the congregation hears Coltrane's spoken word poetry from the album. I will do all I can to be worthy of Thee, O Lord. There is none other. God is. It is so beautiful. The church has faced spiritual and logistical challenges over the past five decades. In 1981, for instance, the Kings battled a lawsuit from the musician's widow, Alice Coltrane, after what the Kings say was a theological falling out. Among other things, Alice wanted a more staid approach, fewer saxophones, more meditation. The congregation has moved often amid San Francisco's cycles of gentrification, enjoying seven addresses since 1969. In 2022, they moved to its current home at 2 Marina Boulevard. The African Orthodox Church granted sainthood to Coltrane in 1982. Services at St. John's are held each Sunday at 11 a.m. with a combination of Coltrane's spoken word recordings and traditional scripture. The King's ecstatic experience of discovering Coltrane is reflected in the church's Byzantine-style paintings that depict Coltrane in a white robe, flames flaring from his saxophone. Our next article is totally different from the music of the first one, and this is under the category of ecology. It's by Kylie Bentz, and it is entitled Second Nature. A new generation is discovering the rambling southern root of the country's first great environmentalist. Let's see what this has to say. Launching his kayak into the St. John's River on a nearly cloudless day in northern Florida, a retired environmental engineer named Dean Campbell heads south, leading a tour to Mount Royal, an ancient indigenous burial mound that is now encircled by a suburban development. Campbell paddles with expert flicks of the wrist, gliding past fields of water lilies and the shell of an abandoned, half-sunk boat. Silver fish leap above the surface, twisting like gymnasts, and a pet peacock screeches from the shore. We disembark beside a long wooden dock, walking through a neighborhood of neat lawns and towering palm trees until we come to a hill marked with a state historical sign for the Mount Royal site. The mound slope is gradual and grassy, its summit shadowed by mature live oaks. Tendrils of Spanish moss tremble in the breeze, and the sand is soft beneath our feet. Standing along the St. John's and gazing at Mount Royal, we are following in the footsteps of William Bartram, the American naturalist and writer who visited this spot several times in the 18th century. In 1773, Bartram left his home in Pennsylvania and embarked on a four-year journey throughout the Southeast that would eventually yield Travels, his sprawling, poetic account of the landscapes, plants, animals, and people he encountered in Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas, Tennessee, Alabama, Louisiana, and Mississippi. Part travelogue, part spiritual memoir, and part scientific catalog, Travels extols Bartram's belief in nature's interconnectedness and the preciousness of all its creatures. In his introduction, Bartram celebrates the azalea's show of mirth and gaiety and delights in the sportive movements of the Venus flytrap. He believed that animals were capable of premeditation and perseverance, and he wrote with feeling about the filial affections of a loyal bear cub. The St. John's served as the main thoroughfare for Bartram's travels in Florida as he recorded his impressions of the area's ferocious alligators, roaring terribly and belching floods of water, and of freshwater springs, so extremely clear as to be absolutely diaphanous or transparent as the ether. His book soon brought wide attention to many unheralded natural wonders in the South, turning the Floridian wilderness into a focus of international scientific fascination and literary inspiration. Bartram's rambling route has attracted curious scholars, wanderers, and artists ever since. Although Travels was published in Philadelphia, London, and Paris in the 1790s, appreciation for Bartram's work declined during the 19th century, and another major edition in the United States did not appear until 1928. In 1958, the preface to a new edition announced its aim to make Bartram live again. In the 21st century, a Bartram revival is underway, led by enthusiasts like Campbell, who call themselves Bartramites and refer to William as Billy, as if he were an old friend. Renewed interest in Bartram's writing, art, and contributions to natural history is fueling new scholarship, a biennial conference, and a movement to recognize Bartram's root nationally. Bartram's work and his holistic philosophy of nature are not only an invitation to imagine a wilder southern past, they also contain a blueprint for a better future, one where nature is both protected and restored. With climate change and population growth imperiling what's left of the wilderness of Bartram's day, that vision has never been more urgent. The shiny hull of Campbell's kayak is decorated with a sticker that reads, "In the wake of William Bartram," and he has spent a lifetime studying the river with a well-loved copy of Travels nestled in the bow of his boat. Visiting sites like Mount Royal is special, Campbell said, because you can know beyond a shadow of a doubt that you're right where he was. Campbell first learned about Bartram in the 1980s when he was working for the St. John's River Water Management District in Northern California's Putnam County, where he grew up, and where Mount Royal is located. Using Travels, Campbell pieced together the pre-colonial history of the river before industry and tourism changed the landscape. Through Bartram's eyes, Campbell says, he could see what the St. John's once was and what it might be again. At Mount Royal, Campbell opens his worn copy of Travels, its pages thick with curling post-its and scribbled notes. He reads aloud, "Continually impelled by a restless spirit of curiosity, my chief happiness consisted in tracing and admiring the infinite power, majesty, and perfection of the great Almighty Creator, and in the contemplation that I might be instrumental in discovering some original productions of nature which might become useful to society." As Campbell reads, a red-winged blackbird swoops down from the trees, eavesdropping. Bartram's work has indeed been useful to society in ways he could never have foreseen, though the true value of Travels is it allows us to act on our best intentions, to seek harmony with the earth rather than selfish dominion. When you read Bartram, there's a sense of hope that we can do better. And of course, in today's world, that's an outstanding reminder that we all can do better in taking care of our earth. Well, the next article moves along to national treasure. We've had genius, and that was John Coltrane, and music. We had ecology, and that was William Bartram and his studies along the St. John's River. And now, this is a little bit different. National treasure, this is by Rachel Neuer. Heads up, how an eye-popping museum specimen boosted the beleaguered blue whale. Sounds like a mystery. By the turn of the 20th century, the United States National Museum, now the Smithsonian's Arts and Industries Building, had assembled an impressive display of whale skeletons. But for biology curator Frederick W. True, the collection would not be complete until it included a, quote, blower, or a whale of truly epic proportions. A pioneer in the study of taxonomy and evolutionary relationships among whales, True specifically wanted a specimen of the largest living animal on Earth, the sulfur bottom whale, more commonly known as the blue whale. Back then, most scientists and ordinary citizens saw whaling as an innocuous industry that pursued a seemingly unlimited supply of the world's monsters of the deep, as the media was fond of calling whales. At this time, big was also a big thing, says John Ososki, a marine mammal specialist at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. The American public in the early 20th century was in the grips of dinosaur mania, when it was common practice for huge skeletons and fossils to go on public display. And there was great demand to see these awesome creatures, Ossoski adds. True was definitely aware of the value of enticing the public with an enormous specimen. To fulfill the museum's quest for a giant, True traveled to Newfoundland, Canada, and enlisted the help of local whalers. The nautical networking paid off in the summer of 1903 when whalers at Hermitage Bay brought in a 78-foot-long, 70-ton adult male North Atlantic blue whale. Waiting on the boat ramp, True's museum colleagues snapped into action and began plastering the animal's tail before the rest of the body had even been fully hauled out of the water. They spent the next 10 hours working from tail to head to make a full-body cast of the dead animal. The plaster model wasn't all the Smithsonian scientists were after, though. Because models are not actual natural history specimens, the cast would be of little scientific value for studying the morphology and life histories of blue whales. So the team also collected the skeleton of the mammoth whale, as the newspapers referred to it. Both model and skeleton were displayed at the 1904 St. Louis World's Fair before making their way to the Smithsonian. More than a century later, the animal's skull is thought to be one of the largest in any scientific collection in the world. In 1916, 2 years after True died, the Hall of Marine Life opened at what is now known as the National Museum of Natural History. For more than 4 decades, the skull and model entertained visitors who came to marvel at a whale of such size that it could provide commodious quarters for Jonah, as one headline proclaimed. By the 1960s, though, sensibilities had changed. The modern environmental movement was blossoming in the U.S., and reports of steeply declining species had propelled conservation to the forefront of scientists' minds. In preparation for a new exhibition that opened in 1963 called Life in the Sea, Smithsonian curators took down the old blue whale model. Unlike the model, the original blue whale skull was featured in the new show, but now the former object of celebration and wonder had transformed into a poignant symbol of loss. As Arthur Remington Kellogg, Assistant Secretary of the Smithsonian, lamented in his speech heralding the new exhibition, "We are now observing the closing days of the existence of the blue whale in our oceans. Indeed, some of you at this opening may never again have the opportunity to see a real blue whale, except in museums." Fortunately, Kellogg's dire predictions did not come to pass, although it's estimated that 99% of blue whales disappeared during the era of commercial whaling. In recent decades, the species population has rebounded in a major way, with between 10 and 25,000 populating our oceans today. This uptick is due mainly to new conservation legislation, which was shaped in part by Smithsonian scientists, especially mammals curator Charles Handley. A strong supporter of the 1972 Marine Mammal Protection Act, Handley succeeded in efforts to list 8 large whale species under the Endangered Species Conservation Act, the legislative predecessor to the Endangered Species Act of 1973. An international moratorium on commercial whaling, which most countries have abided by since 1985, also helped blue whales recover. In a way, the skull assisted in ushering in these changes, too. Public awareness of whales and their plight led to political and legislative action to protect them, Ossoski says. An iconic specimen such as our blue whale skull certainly played a role in that. By the time the Life in the Sea exhibition closed in 1998, the blue whale skull had accomplished its mission of helping bring its species back from the edge of extinction. So Smithsonian curators decided to retire the old skull from public view in favor of spotlighting species that currently face more pressing conservation threats, such as right whales and, more recently, Rice's whales. The Rice's whale exhibit, which opened in the St. Ocean Hall in November, features a baleen plate from a deceased whale along with plastic extracted from the animal's stomach. Since 2007, the blue whale skull has quietly resided at the Garber Preservation Restoration and Storage Facility in Suitfield, Maryland, in a room where the 25-foot-high ceiling is just tall enough to accommodate it. For now, there are no immediate plans to put the gargantuan relic back on public display. But someday, perhaps, the skull will reappear in an exhibition showcasing the conservation that helped to save some of the ocean's most majestic creatures. Well, that is a wonderful story to think that the blue whale has come back so successfully. Certainly William Bartram, who was not in the ocean because he stayed mostly on the St. John's River in Florida and other southern states, would be delighted to hear about that success story with conservation. And finally, from Ask Smithsonian, a couple of questions that readers have written in. The first one is, why is Saturn's moon Titan the only moon in the solar system with a significant atmosphere? And that's from Sheboygan Falls, Wisconsin, Kurt Peterson. Well, the answer is from Mike Alexanderson and Rosemary Pike, who are researchers at the Center for Astrophysics in Harvard and Smithsonian. Titan's atmosphere is about 95% nitrogen and 5% methane. The methane holds the atmosphere together, allowing seasons and weather patterns to form. One reason methane stays in the atmosphere is that Titan is the perfect distance from the sun to have a temperature and pressure where solid, liquid, and vapor forms of methane can coexist. Scientists call this the triple point. Earth is at the triple point for H2O. Other moons also have atmospheres, though they're much thinner. On our own moon, each cubic centimeter of atmosphere contains just one molecule for every 10 trillion found in Earth's. And finally, which battle played a more crucial role in the Civil War, Vicksburg or Gettysburg? From John J. Rouse of St. Cloud, Minnesota. The answer from Frank Blazich, curator of military history at the National Museum of American History, says the Siege of Vicksburg, which raged from May 18 to July 4, 1863, had a more significant outcome than the Battle of Gettysburg, which lasted from July 1 to July 3 of that year. At Vicksburg, Major General Ulysses S. Grant forced the surrender of the Citadel, the last major Confederate stronghold on the Mississippi River, isolating Confederate resources in Arkansas, Texas, and parts of Louisiana, while providing the U.S. Army control of the Mississippi River. Grant also forced the complete surrender of the 30,000 Confederate soldiers in the Department of Mississippi in East Louisiana. In contrast, Gettysburg cost the Confederates political support and inflicted heavy casualties, but it did not destroy the Army of Northern Virginia. It did boost the Army of the Potomac's morale at a critical point and gave President Abraham Lincoln an occasion to redefine the war's purpose with his Gettysburg Address. Well, you have been listening to Smithsonian on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. This is Margie Lohoff saying goodbye from Owl Radio.